Je vais commencer en français seulement à dire merci à Philippe pour cette introduction si généreuse et pour avoir lu mes ouvrages avec intelligence caractéristique. Et c'est un grand plaisir d'être ici. Merci aussi à Denis Béranger pour cette invitation. C'est un grand honneur d'être ici. Et merci à vous tous pour votre attendance. Alors, je vais continuer en anglais, qui est mieux pour moi et mieux pour vous. Et peut-être après, on peut discuter en français, parce que je pratique encore français. So, I have a thesis for you this evening that I would like to try to persuade you of. And perhaps you will not be in agreement with it, and I'm eager for your challenges and objections in the discussion. And here is the thesis. That it is wrong to say that there is only a single kind of judicial and political conservative in the United States today. In fact, there are three separate strands of legal conservatism in the country and on the court. The differences among these three strands are as important as the similarities, and they may in fact result in questions like gay marriage and healthcare leading to surprising fissures that will not divide along traditional party lines. And here are the three strains of conservatism that I want to discuss with you. First, the libertarians. Second, the Tea Party constitutionalists. And third, the pro-executive conservatives. And although they agree in theory on certain broad principles, like cutting taxes and limiting congressional power, these three strands are often in significant tensions with each other. So here are some of the tensions. Libertarian conservatives are socially liberal. They support abortion and gay rights, while the socially conservative Tea Party constitutionalists strenuously oppose abortion and gay rights. Pro-executive conservatives support broad presidential authority over the New Deal administrative state, which the libertarians and Tea Party conservatives want to dismantle brick by brick. Libertarian and Tea Party conservatives want to limit federal power to protect states' rights. Pro-business and pro-executive conservatives are willing to extend federal power to protect the national uniformity that business interests prefer. The Libertarian and Tea Party conservatives opposed the financial bailout started by President Bush and continued by President Obama, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, on economic and constitutional grounds. Indeed, that program spawned the Tea Party movement. Protests against it were what ignited the Tea Party people originally, whereas the pro-national power, pro-executive conservatives enthusiastically supported the bailout. Libertarian conservatives unapologetically embrace constitutional judicial activism and have encouraged courts to extend the unenumerated right to privacy, to protect abortion rights, gay marriage, and to strike down the health care mandate. Tea Party and pro-executive conservatives are so haunted by the specter of Roe v. Wade, the abortion decision, that they strenuously reject these arguments. On the Supreme Court, the libertarians and the Tea Party conservatives have only one relatively consistent ally each. In fact, this is a very sophisticated crowd, so I'm going to step on my punchline by asking you, who is the consistent ally of the libertarians? Pro-socially liberal, pro-abortion, pro-gay marriage, but suspicious of national regulation. I can call on people because I'm a law professor, but does it, any guesses?
Since it can't be the two, maybe the three. It can't be the Tea Party, so maybe the pro-executive.
No, I'm asking essentially who would be the libertarian? There's one libertarian and there's one Tea Party guy, and the other three are pro-executive. Yeah, yeah, that's it. Well, it's too much inside baseball.
The alliance between
exactly
the two.
The libertarian is Anthony Kennedy, very pro-abortion, pro-gay rights, anti-congressional power. Mm-hmm. The Tea Party, Justice.
Scalia
is a very good guess because he is also socially conservative, the way the Tea Party people are, but he's not as suspicious of national power as you might think, so it's a good guess, but it's Scalia's friend...
Rehnquist
had sympathies like that, but he's now gone. Clarence Thomas is the Tea Party justice. Socially conservative, but fiercely opposed to the entire post-New Deal administrative state.
Yes.
Yes. And that leaves the remaining three conservatives, John Roberts, Samuel Alito, and Antonin Scalia, are all pro-executive conservatives. And as we'll see, their formative experience was in the executive branch. They all worked for the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department or for the White House. And as a result, they're much more committed to extending national power than to challenging it at the core. And for this reason, although I'm not making any predictions in this august seminar, I will argue that it would be simplistic to imagine that the healthcare decision, which we expect next year, will be five votes to strike it down and four liberal votes to uphold it. It's just as likely that there might be a fairly broad bipartisan decision in which the three pro-executive conservatives join the four pro-national power liberals and uphold the healthcare mandate. So that's my broad thesis, that these three strands are in tensions with each other, that they may divide on questions like gay marriage and healthcare. And now I just want to say a little bit about the three groups and where they came from and what their intellectual approach is and why they disagree with each other about so many things. So let's begin with the libertarian conservatives who have led the constitutional challenges to healthcare reform. The academic leaders of the libertarian conservative movements, if you want to read their works, which are interesting, are people like Randy Barnett of Georgetown Law School and Richard Epstein, who's now at the NYU Law School. The leading libertarian think tank in Washington is called the Cato Institute, and there are leading libertarian judges on the lower courts like Douglas Ginsburg, who in 1995 wrote an article for the magazine of the Cato Institute, Regulation, calling for the resurrection of what he called the Constitution in Exile, by which he meant limitations on federal power that the Supreme Court stopped enforcing after the New Deal. And a few years ago, 6 years ago, I wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine describing this Constitution in Exile movement and quoting Cass Sunstein, who's now the Obama regulatory czar, who predicted that the success of this movement, as Barnett and Epstein defined it, would mean that many decisions of the New Deal regulatory state would be unconstitutional. The Federal Communications Commission, the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Labor Relations Board, all would be constitutionally imperiled. It would mean, Sunstein predicted, that the Social Security Act might be under constitutional stress. And he even continued that independent regulatory agencies like the Securities Exchange Commission and the Federal Reserve might themselves be challenged on constitutional grounds, as well as applications of the Endangered Species Act and Clean Water Act, environmental laws and health regulations. And then in what Sunstein described as an extreme nightmare scenario, minimum wage laws and maximum hour regulations passed during the Progressive Era might also be under stress. Now, Sunstein and I were criticized at the time, mostly by non-libertarian thinkers, for exaggerating the goals of this movement. But I'm here to report, ladies and gentlemen, that Sunstein's extreme nightmare scenario has now come to pass, and the arguments that the libertarians have embraced in the healthcare lawsuits do indeed challenge at their core the constitutionality of the federal regulatory agencies and of maximum hour and minimum wage laws. And it is remarkable to read the briefs in the healthcare case and see how explicitly these libertarian arguments are being made. Now, as framed by Randy Barnett and other libertarian strategists, the healthcare lawsuits purport to be about federalism, the proper division between federal and state power. In a brief on behalf of the Cato Institute challenging the healthcare mandate in Virginia, Barnett argues that the mandate cedes Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. The Constitution allows Congress to regulate interstate commerce. Barnett says that this includes the power to regulate economic activity, but not economic inactivity. And several judges in America, in Virginia and Florida, have accepted the idea that the decision not to buy health insurance is a form of economic inactivity, not of economic activity, and therefore cannot be regulated under the Commerce Clause. But as critics have noted, Barnett's principal objection to the mandate has nothing to do with federalism. It's a libertarian objection that no government, whether the federal government or the states, can coerce individuals to buy goods or services that they don't want to buy. And this is what we call the Broccoli objection, because in Florida, the district judge objected that if Congress can require people to buy health insurance, it could also require that people buy and consume broccoli. Others are very concerned that Americans will be forced to buy gym memberships. by Congress and be forced to go to health clubs to go jogging. And Barnett himself is very worried about the gym membership problem, and also that Congress may require every American to buy a new Chevy Impala car every year. So this is the main rhetorical argument against healthcare, but it's not a frivolous objection, because you know that when you object to being forced to buy broccoli or gym memberships or Chevy Impalas, you're not talking about intrusions on states' rights, you're making an argument about individual liberty. They believe neither the states nor the federal government could force people to buy broccoli or gym memberships. And indeed, last February, the South Dakota House of Representatives protested against the healthcare mandate by introducing a bill that the sponsors claimed was obviously unconstitutional, that would have forced all people over the age of 21 to buy a gun. And I know you're all very impressed in France with the enthusiasm of our gun rights devotions, but even most Americans don't think that the government could force them to buy a gun. But the South Dakota representatives wanted to say, this is an obviously unconstitutional law. One of the sponsors said, do we believe that a state could force citizens to buy firearms? Of course not, but we don't believe the federal government can order every citizen to buy health insurance. So you see, this may seem like a technical point, but it goes to the heart of the libertarian objection. It's not about federalism. They would have just as strong objection to the healthcare mandate if it were passed by the states as if it were passed by Congress. Now, but under what possible constitutional precedents could it be objected that Congress and the states lack the power to force people to buy what they don't want to buy? In fact, there is a notorious line of cases that was repudiated in the 1930s. This is associated with the case called Lochner, which many of you know, which in 1905 struck down a New York law setting maximum hours for bakers on the grounds that individuals should be able to arrange their economic affairs without being wards of the state. And the idea was that neither the states nor the federal government could interfere with freedom of contract or force people to engage in unwanted economic associations. After relying on cases associated with Lochner to strike down Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, the Supreme Court abruptly reversed course and repudiated the ruling in 1937, stressing that the Constitution does not speak of freedom of contract. Now, here's something that's very important to understand about the attitude of most non-libertarian conservatives toward Lochner. Conservative opponents of Roe v. Wade, including John Roberts, Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, Antonin Scalia, all have denounced Lochner because they believe that resurrecting a right to freedom of contract would encourage judges to enforce other rights not listed in the text of the Constitution, like the right to privacy. So you see, it's an effort to resist the legitimacy of Roe v. Wade that leads these conservative judges to resist Lochner. Robert Bork, the celebrated rejected Supreme Court nominee, in his book The Tempting of America says, who says Roe must say Lochner? The wrongness of Lochner was long a conservative article of faith. In fact, it was the main rhetorical objection to judicial activism practiced by liberals ever since the 1960s. Justice Antonin Scalia has gone even further, insisting in the 1980s that the only way the conservative legal movement could seize the mantle of judicial restraint was by repudiating the libertarian vision of economic liberty associated with Lochner. And in an interesting debate at the Cato Institute in 1984, Scalia clashed publicly with his former University of Chicago colleague, Richard Epstein, warning that conservatives should resist the temptation to overturn laws in the name of rights or liberties not explicitly listed in the Constitution, whether economic liberties such as Lochner or privacy rights such as Roe v. Wade. When Epstein heard what Scalia had to say, his head almost exploded. He was so upset by this, and he threw away his prepared remarks, and he insisted that judges resist the conventional wisdom that Scalia was embracing and take a much more aggressive stand in defending economic liberties. Epstein said there are many blatantly inappropriate statutes that cry out for a quick and easy kill, and he encouraged judges to embrace economic judicial activism. Now, unlike Randy Barnett, Epstein has argued candidly, and I think honestly, that the healthcare mandate, in his view, violates a sweeping libertarian right of freedom of contract that constrains not only Congress, but the states as well. To uphold the mandate, Epstein wrote recently, invites the government to force me to buy everything from exercise machines to bicycles. There's the gym membership objection again, because there's always some good that the coercive use of state authority can advance. And then Epstein says, the ironic point is that this is not a Commerce Clause argument as such, for in my view, any state statute would be subject to the same objection, even though the state has plenary police powers. And one of the healthcare lawsuits is just as candid about Epstein, about trying to revive this libertarian vision of economic judicial activism associated with the Lochner era. There's a case called Bryant versus Holder, brought by the Lieutenant Governor of Mississippi called Philip Bryant. And this brief cites cases from the Lochner era to argue that the right to be free from government coercion is a fundamental right, since individuals have a due process right not to enter into a contract to purchase health insurance from a corporate stranger. After citing Milton Friedman and other libertarian theorists, the state of Mississippi concludes that the refusal to enter into a contract in the face of an illegitimate demand for a contract is subject to protection under the 5th and 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So, in addition to arguing for a resurrection of liberty of contract that would call into question minimum wage and maximum hour laws, this is Cass Sunstein's extreme nightmare scenario. Here's an interesting twist. The state of Mississippi also invokes a case that represents the extreme nightmare scenario of many conservatives, namely Roe versus Wade. In a surprising but intellectually coherent twist, the libertarian Lieutenant Governor Bryant notes that it's not only the economic liberty cases that recognize a right to an unenumerated right of personal autonomy. That's also been recognized in Roe and in the case that reaffirmed it, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, in 1993. The brief says, in Casey, the court described Roe as a right of personal autonomy that protects all intimate and personal choices central to personal dignity. The right of privacy guarantees our liberty to make intimate personal decisions relating to health, dignity, and autonomy. Therefore, it must also protect our right not to apply for or buy health insurance. If the Constitution prohibits governments from dictating decisions that full adult humans can otherwise make for themselves, how can the same Constitution authorize Congress to force adult citizens to enter into private contracts? And in a delicious irony, the brief cites the concurring opinion in Roe v. Wade, written by William O. Douglas, the great liberal judicial activist from the 1960s, who insisted that the broad zone of privacy recognized by Roe should include not only abortion, but a more general right to care for one's health or persons. So you see, in this health care lawsuit from Mississippi comes the libertarian position in its unadulterated form, invoking both Roe v. Wade and Lochner to argue against the idea that Americans could be forced to buy health insurance or broccoli. On the current Supreme Court, there is only one justice who might possibly consider striking down the health care mandate in the name of the privacy right recognized in Roe v. Wade. And that, as we've already discussed, is Anthony Kennedy. Of all the conservative justices, Kennedy is the most activist in his willingness to strike down federal and state laws. Between 2006 and 2010, the court struck down 6 acts of Congress. Kennedy voted with a majority in 5 of those cases, more than any other conservative justice. Moreover, Kennedy has embraced the most extreme and expansive libertarian vision of personal autonomy. He was the one who wrote that 1993 opinion upholding Roe v. Wade, where he said, liberty presumes an autonomy of self that includes freedom of thought, belief, expression, and certain intimate conduct. He also said in that case, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own conception of meaning, of the universe, and the mystery of human life. Justice Scalia unkindly ridiculed that as the sweet mystery of life passage. I thought it was a little purple in its pretension. But given Kennedy's fervent beliefs about the need to protect the relationship between parents and children, as well as individual autonomy to make major life decisions, it's not hard to imagine him being sympathetic to the claim that the health mandate violates an individual's right to make basic health decisions for themselves and their families. But no justice would join Kennedy in extending Roe v. Wade to strike down the mandate, because all of the other conservatives, the 3 pro-executives, Scalia, Alito, and Roberts, and the Tea Party Justice Thomas, are so opposed to Roe v. Wade that they would resist any effort to resurrect it. As for liberty of contract, Kennedy might agree instinctively with Governor Bryant that freedom from government coercion is deeply rooted in this nation's history. His opinions are full of this anti-coercion rhetoric. But in practice, he's been less activist in economic liberty cases than libertarians hoped. He disappointed libertarians like Barnett and Epstein by voting in 1995 to allow a city in Connecticut to seize a woman's home as part of a planned shopping center complex that was later never built. This was a very controversial decision that inspired libertarian protests in the streets. Indeed, there were pickets in front of poor Justice Souter's home in New Hampshire and efforts by the town council to seize Justice Souter's home for redevelopment in protest against this expansive use of the state police power. But Kennedy provided the 6th vote, I think, in that case to allow the taking, and therefore he is unlikely to accept the libertarian claim that the compelled purchase of health insurance constitutes a taking of private property under the 5th Amendment. So that's my first category, the libertarians. Kennedy is principled in his social and economic libertarianism. It's possible to imagine him in the same Supreme Court term. Imagine the irony of this. Imagine how much it would infuriate the right or the left. He might, in the same term, vote to recognize a right to gay marriage and to strike down the healthcare mandate, all in the same, in the name of the same expansive right of personal autonomy. But no other conservative justice would join him. All right, category two, the Tea Party conservatives. Although they strenuously resist the libertarian conservative embrace of gay marriage and the right to choose, Tea Party conservatives share with the libertarians a deep suspicion of federal power. And if you want an example of a Tea Party constitutionalist in its most perfect expression, look no further than a newly elected senator whose name is Michael Lee, a Utah Republican. He has impeccable establishment legal credentials. He was the son of Ronald Reagan's Solicitor General Rex Lee. He twice clerked for Justice Alito before Alito joined the Supreme Court. He's also a devout Mormon and social conservative who fervently opposes Roe v. Wade. On the campaign trail, he suggested that much of what the federal government does is unconstitutional. He said the Constitution doesn't give the Congress the power to redistribute our wealth. He said he would wind down Social Security and return Medicaid to the states. Like other Tea Party enthusiasts, he's expressed an interest in a theory called nullification, based on the idea that states have the right to disregard federal laws, such as health care reform, that they believe are unconstitutional. And last year, Lee endorsed a bill, recently signed into law in Utah, that would require the state to opt out of the federal reform when the state determines that opting out is in the best interest of the citizen and the state. Healthcare nullification laws have been passed in 5 states, or pending in 16 more. And nullification, obviously, seems to ignore the supremacy clause of the Constitution, which says that federal laws are supreme over state laws to the contrary. But in an interesting book, Nullification, How to Resist Federal Tyranny, the Bible of the Tea Party's nullification movement, an author called Thomas Woods argues that the supremacy clause only says that laws made in pursuance of the Constitution are supreme, and the state governments are free to make their own judgments about which laws are in pursuance of the Constitution. Similar laws, of course, were made not only by Jefferson and Madison, as Philippe has written, but also by Daniel Calhoun and other Southern secessionists who questioned federal supremacy before the Civil War. One would have thought that these arguments were decisively rejected by Lincoln and on the battlefield of Appomattox, but they are now fashionable in America once again.
With the Black Calhounian.
Black Calhounian, Clarence Thomas, who's embraced it explicitly. And now you see why Thomas is the Tea Party justice avant la lettre. But what I want to urge all of you, as you write about the Tea Party, is not to dismiss it as a group of vulgar roots. It's a coherent movement, and it's a movement with popular roots. In polls and mission statements at rallies across the country, Tea Party activists have consistently identified restoring the Constitution as their central goal. And although many dismiss it as a sort of incohesive mix of social conservatism and anti-government libertarianism, in fact, there is a clear constitutional vision at the heart of the Tea Party movement, however surprising it may seem to non-initiatives. It's based on a work that I want to recommend to all of you who are interested in delving further into this fascinating subject, written by a scholar called W. Cleon Skousen. And his book is called The 5,000-Year Leap, and it has become the Bible of the Tea Party movement. If you go to Tea Party rallies, as I've had the pleasure of doing, you will see school teachers and young men and women and people wearing tri-corner hats and wearing knee breeches waving this book written by Skousen.
Excuse me, would you spell the name of the guy?
Absolutely. It's S-K-O-U-S-E-N. Skousen, W. Cleon Skousen. I can't believe that I'm going to be adding to his Amazon sales by recommending the book, but in fact, my endorsement is far less valuable than that of Glenn Beck. He made it a national bestseller in 2009 by endorsing the Skousen book and making it the Bible of the Tea Party movement. Skousen, I should say, is a rather controversial character. Before he died in 2006 at the age of 92, he had been dismissed by many traditionalist conservatives, including William F. Buckley, as a conspiracy-mongering extremist. While studying the constitutional excesses of the New Deal during the Great Depression, he conceived of the idea of writing a popular primer to the Founders' Constitution. He wrote in 1948 a book called Prophecy in Modern Times, which included a providential view of the U.S. Constitution set out in Mormon scripture, which views the Constitution as divinely inspired and on the verge of destruction, and the Mormon Church as its salvation. He published in 1958 The Naked Communist, which argued that Soviet communists were conspiring to create one world government, pursuing a list of goals, including the promotion of homosexuality, the elimination of school prayer, and the discrediting of the American Constitution. Around this time, he became a vocal supporter of the John Birch Society, which is a group of nativist conservatives in the 50s, around the time that its president accused Dwight Eisenhower of being a communist sympathizer, William F. Buckley, the American traditionalist conservative, denounced Welsh and cut all ties between mainstream conservatism and the Birchers for a generation. And in 70, Skousen published The Naked Capitalist, which accused dynastic cabal, including international bankers like the Rockefellers, of conspiring to manipulate communism and fascism to promote one world government. The book was so extreme that in 1979, the Mormon Church distanced itself from Skousen. So this was an author who was considered a fringe, marginal character until he was rediscovered by Glenn Beck in 2009. But the book is worth reading because it's 101 questions for constitutional candidates, conveniently reproduced in an index at the end, is slavishly, faithfully followed by Tea Party candidates and senators, and even by Supreme Court justices. Tea Party groups like Freedom Works, run by Dick Armey, the former House Majority Leader, have emphasized the movement's libertarianism and downplayed the social conservatism. But several of Skousen's principles of constitutional faithfulness stress the role of religious virtue. The fourth principle, without religion, the government of a free people cannot be maintained, criticizes the Supreme Court for having misinterpreted Thomas Jefferson's metaphor of a wall separating church and state. I attended one of these constitutional seminars in Washington where people get together and write in little workbooks the correct answer to historical questions according to the Skousenite worldview. And the teacher, who I think was a former contractor who was leading the seminar, said several times, Jefferson was not an atheist. He was much more religious than we commonly think. And was trying to reconceive Jefferson as a social conservative of sorts. Skousen also insisted that the First Amendment's prohibition on the federal establishment of religion was not intended to separate church and state, but to prevent the federal government from disestablishing religion in the seven states that had a formally established denominations during the founding era. And Skousen's revisionist history helps to explain the view of Tea Party candidates such as Christy O'Donnell, who ran for Senate in Delaware, who asked in a debate, where in the Constitution is the separation of church and state? She was ridiculed for this, but she in fact was faithfully following Skousen. The Skousen principles also suggest that most federal regulatory agencies are unconstitutional, including the Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Communications Commission, the Department of Education and Welfare, and many other extreme views questioning the constitutionality of the Federal Reserve, of the Social Security system, are all in the book. Lee, like many Tea Party candidates, also calls for repeal of the 16th and 17th Amendments to the Constitution. The 16th authorizes a federal income tax. The 17th authorizes the direct election of senators. Both of these are views as affronts to states' rights. And Skousen also calls for the elimination of Social Security, welfare, and the national debt. Now, in addition to having influenced an entire movement, thanks to Glenn Beck, Skousen also appears to have fans on the Supreme Court. I was told by Skousen's son, Paul Skousen, that two Supreme Court justices have read his books and taken his classes, and of those two, Clarence Thomas can be described as the complete Tea Party constitutionalist. Thomas's wife provoked controversy in America by stumping at Tea Party rallies, and I attended a rally right before the last elections where Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, got up and said, a wave is about to sweep across Washington, our enemies will realize our power. She was unapologetically partisan on behalf of Tea Party principles. On the court, Thomas has endorsed the radically limited vision of Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce, which calls into question the constitutionality of many federal regulatory agencies. Also, like Skousen, Thomas has insisted that the founders intended to prevent the federal government from disestablishing state churches, but not from promoting religion in other ways. Congress need not observe strict separation between church and state or steer clear of the subject of religion, Thomas wrote in a 2005 opinion. Thomas also shares the Tea Party movement's hostility to Washington elites, and he spends the summer driving around America in a motor coach, a recreational vehicle, so he can meet what he calls real Americans. And he told his friend Rush Limbaugh, somehow, someone told me the best people in America are in the RV parks. I meet them at truck stops, rest stops. These are my kind of people. So this remarkable combination, you see, of anti-elitism, social conservatism, and anti-federal government, states' rights, libertarianism makes Thomas the complete Tea Party justice. Alone among the justices on the court, Thomas has embraced a radically limited vision of congressional power to regulate interstate commerce that the Tea Party constitutionalists share with the libertarians. Thomas got a lot of heat during his confirmation hearings from Senator Joseph Biden, now the Vice President of the United States, for having flirted with the works of Richard Epstein. And indeed, at the confirmation hearings, Biden waved a copy of Richard Epstein's book, Takings, which Thomas had endorsed, and said, are you going to enact the theories of this radical book? And Thomas said, absolutely not. This was just youthful intellectual exploration. I was young. I needed the money. I don't know what he was saying, but he was suggesting that he was just not that attached to the theories of Richard Epstein. Imagine the surprise of Biden and many others when just 4 years later, in 1995, Thomas wrote a concurring opinion in the Lopez case that literally wrote Epstein's ideas into the U.S. reports. By a 5-4 majority, the majority of the court struck down a federal law banning guns in school zones, arguing that this fell outside of Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. Thomas took a much more extreme view. He said the real problem was with the larger decisions during the New Deal that had abandoned the idea of severe limits on Congress's commerce power. He assailed his liberal colleagues for characterizing the first 150 years of this court's case law as a wrong turn. And he said, if anything, the wrong turn was the departure in the 1930s from a century of half the precedent. In this Lopez concurrence, he questioned an opinion, forgive me for getting into the weeds, but it's important in the healthcare challenges. It was called Wickard and Filburn. This was the New Deal era case that overturned the idea of radically limited congressional power and allowed Congress to regulate a farmer who was growing wheat in his backyard purely for domestic consumption. And the theory of the case was if you only ate your domestically grown wheat, then you might buy less interstate wheat, and that would have a very trivial but indirect effect on interstate commerce. So for Thomas and the Tea Party people, the Wickard and Filburn case was a terrible expansion of congressional power. Thomas has called for the Wickard case to be reexamined. The Supreme Court had a chance to reexamine the Wickard case in the Gonzales and Raich case in 2008, which was a challenge to the federal government's attempt to enforce drug laws that conflict with efforts by California and other states to allow the use of medical marijuana. Randy Barnett, the leader of the Libertarians, begged the court to overturn the Wickard case, but the court rejected his entreaties by a 6-3 vote. And in an opinion joined by Justice Scalia, the pro-executive, pro-national power conservative, the court reaffirmed the Wickard case and held that Congress can regulate purely intrastate activity that is not itself commercial if failure to regulate that class would undercut the regulation of the interstate market in that commodity. Thomas was the only justice to question Wickard. He cited Randy Barnett. He called for a pre-New Deal understanding of the Commerce Clause. So therefore, I count again only one justice, Thomas, as a sure vote for striking down the health care mandate as exceeding Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. This brings me to my third and final category, which I can present relatively quickly because you'll quickly grasp the broad contours of the pro-executive conservatives. It's no surprise, I said, that Scalia, Roberts, and Alito are all strong proponents of executive power, all served in the Ford or Reagan administration's Office of Legal Counsel or White House Counsel's Office. During that time, all came to see a strong presidency as the only way to defend conservative ideals from the encroachments of a Democratic Congress, liberal courts, and obstreperous bureaucrats. The crucible in which their theory, which they call the unitary executive theory, was forged was the Reagan-era Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department. The Office of Legal Counsel provides legal advice to the president about the limits of his powers, but it's a kind of intellectual ground zero for legal conservatism, and the office became known as a center of conservative intellectual thought and therefore attracted bright, young, true believers. With the help of deputies like Samuel Alito, the office vigorously asserted the constitutional powers of the unitary executive. The inspiration for the phrase was Alexander Hamilton's call for unity in the executive. And the initial purpose of the unitary executive theory was to strike a blow at the heart of the regulatory state, The idea was that the president needs complete control over the executive branch. Therefore, he needs the power to fire executive officials, including independent counsels and the heads of independent regulatory agencies, like the Securities and Exchange Commission, who didn't share his vision. As Alito recalled in a speech in 2000, when he was at the office in the 1980s, we were strong proponents of the theory of the unitary executive, that all federal executive power is vested by the Constitution and the president. I thought then, and I still think, this theory best captures the meaning of the Constitution's text and structure. In 1988, the Supreme Court rejected the Reagan administration's claim that the independent counsel law was unconstitutional by a 7-1 vote. The decision was written by Rehnquist, who you mentioned, who came of age in the 50s, hating the centralizing excesses of Franklin Roosevelt and therefore had more libertarian strands. The only dissenter from this decision was Scalia, the pro-executive power man, who was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel under President Ford. Now, on the Supreme Court, pro-executive conservatives have shown a noted and widely commented pro-business bias. The Roberts Court, which has completed 5 terms, ruled for business interests 61% of the time, compared with 46% in the last 5 years of the court led by William Rehnquist, 42% by all courts since 1950. These business cases are technical and complex, but they're important. They involve questions like antitrust law, like punitive damages, and they also involve technical but important cases involving federal preemption of inconsistent state jury verdicts. So let me just say this quickly because it's relevant to the healthcare mandate. Ordinarily, if someone is injured by a defective medical device, for example, a heart device that explodes, which is a very unfortunate thing to happen, if you survive, you may well sue, as one gentleman did, a man called Regal. He sued the Medtronic Corporation for badly manufacturing a heart device. He won a big state jury verdict and got a lot of money. The medical company then countersued and said state juries had no power to impose verdicts for exploding devices because medical devices were already regulated by a federal law regulating medical devices, and therefore any inconsistent regulations, whether passed by state legislatures or imposed by state juries, were preempted by the federal regulation. This is a very adventurous and controversial claim because Congress, when it regulated medical devices, according to federal standards, never intended to prevent states from giving remedies for exploding devices. But nevertheless, with the support of the Bush administration, the Roberts Court has been enthusiastically supportive of these preemption claims. These are not partisan cases. The Regal case against the Medtronic company in 2008, which overturned the state jury verdict, was an 8-1 decision, joined by pro-national power liberals like Stephen Breyer. The only dissenter was Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's been very pro-states' rights. During the first 2 years of the Roberts Court, the justices decided 2 preemption cases in favor of the corporate defendants. And sometimes we see the pro-states' rights Clarence Thomas joining the liberals in finding no federal preemption, and the 3 pro-executive conservatives, Alito, Roberts, and Scalia, are dissent. And that was a 2008 case called Wyeth and Levine, a tragic case where a woman who played the guitar had a drug wrongly injected into her arm. The nurse didn't follow the proper procedure. Her arm had to be amputated. As a result, she couldn't play the guitar. I met her and saw she had a terribly sad story. She sued. She won a lot of money. The medical company appealed, and the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote in this case, upheld the jury verdict because Thomas, who cares more about states' rights than about national uniformity, joined the liberals, but you had the 3 national power conservatives dissenting. All right, so now to conclude, what does this mean about the 3 national power conservatives' views about the healthcare mandate? I would be quite, well, let's not say it would be surprising, but it would be inconsistent with their previous decisions for them to embrace a radically limited vision of Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. In that 2005 case regulating medical marijuana, the Gonzalez and Raich case, Justice Scalia joined the liberals and Justice Kennedy in upholding Congress's power to punish those growing marijuana for medical use. Scalia's reasoning was that a ban on homegrown marijuana use was necessary and proper to effectively enforce federal regulations of a nationwide drug market. He stressed that whether we characterize the local behavior or decision at issue is irrelevant to the proper inquiry. Scalia said Congress may regulate even non-economic local activity if that regulation is a necessary part of a more general regulation of interstate commerce. And that's why some observers, including Lawrence Tribe, have noted Scalia's vote in this case as an example of why the pro-national power conservatives should vote to uphold the mandate. And then just last year, Roberts and Alito joined Kennedy and the four liberals in embracing a broad vision of Congress's power to enact civil commitment laws for the mentally ill, sexually dangerous federal prisoners. They rejected the Tea Party vision that Congress can only legislate when it's given explicitly enumerated power in the Constitution. The Tea Party senators have insisted on pointing to the particular constitutional provisions at issue before they vote for a bill, but Roberts and Alito rejected this vision, saying that Congress could act to enforce unenumerated powers under the necessary and proper clause. So for all these reasons, although I'm not predicting confidently because anything can happen on the U.S. Supreme Court, I think it's fair to say that the pro-national power conservatives, Roberts, Alito, and Scalia, have joined a lot of opinions that would make it surprising or inconvenient for them to strike down the healthcare mandate. What are the lessons of my typology, the three types of conservatives? You may have some better ideas than I, but I just want to close by offering you three brief lessons. The first is that ideology matters more than politics. I don't have any doubt that all five of the conservative justices don't like the healthcare mandate as a policy matter, but according to their jurisprudence, only Kennedy and Thomas have ideologies that explicitly would lead them to strike down the mandate on constitutional grounds. The other three would have to struggle to reconcile their previously expressed commitment to broad national power to strike down the mandate. The second point is that background shapes ideology. It's not a coincidence that the three pro-executive power justices had their worldviews shaped in the crucible of the Reagan-era Office of Legal Counsel. It's not a coincidence that Justice Samuel Alito has never held a job outside of the federal executive or judicial branch, and that he's been the most deferential to the executive and to Congress of all the other conservative justices. Similarly, Thomas and Kennedy's libertarian and Tea Party views were shaped by their own youthful reading, by their intellectual explorations, and by their backgrounds. And the third rule, and maybe we can talk a little bit about this as well, is that ideology can, at times, unexpectedly, put the court at odds with public opinion and the president, but usually doesn't. I am a subscriber, as the Democratic Branch book tries to argue, with the thesis that the U.S. Supreme Court tends to follow the broad currents of popular opinion and often provokes backlashes on the rare occasions when it challenges public opinion at its core. But as a general matter, the court has not tended to challenge the president. Not since 1937 has a conservative Supreme Court challenged a Democratic president on issues that he cares intensely about. The great constitutional question that is consuming America is whether 1937 is about to be repeated in 2011 or 2012, and whether after having struck down campaign finance reform, the Supreme Court will also strike down healthcare reform. Although again, I'm not suggesting that it's impossible, because the ideological predispositions of the justices might incline them to uphold healthcare rather than challenge it, this makes it less likely that the court will find itself challenging the president centrally. And that, combined with the stated desire of Chief Justice John Roberts to issue narrow, unanimous decisions and to avoid constitutional conflicts, makes me, I won't say optimistic, but at least cautiously hopeful that the Roberts Court will not revise the errors of the New Deal-era court and, in fact, will uphold health care rather than strike it down. Thank you so much for